Welcome to LSE Share Talk, Conquest Corner. This is Conquest 3. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Paul Kavanagh. Paul Kavanagh is currently the Chief Executive of Patronus Partners, and Paul has worked in the city for many years, and I have the privilege of speaking with Paul today. Hello, Paul, and how are you today?
Yeah, very well indeed, thank you.
Now, Paul, as I've stated, you've been in the city for a little while. You were previously with Kavanagh Killick, and now you've set up another business on your own with your partners. I wanted to firstly just say thank you ever so much for coming on here. But there are still a few people, for unknown reasons, that still are not aware of Paul Kavanagh, and the fact he's been traveling at some speed through the city over the past, I would say, 30 years. Is that being polite now? Mid-80s?
Yeah, no. I think I joined the city in 1986.
86.
And worked for a company called Extel, which is still around, but obviously the internet sort of superseded much of what Extel did. Extel used to provide city stockbrokers with a card, and this card used to display all of the data for every quoted company. At the time, we had the official list, we had the USM, and subsequently we had something called the third market, and those two markets became ultimately replaced by the AIM market. And so it was really preparation of company report and accounts and news wires, but in physical format, and these things tended to have to be filed on a daily basis to keep the filing up to date.
Yeah, I remember that. I spoke to another person on Twitter who mentioned that, Extel Financial. Were they the main people that did that, or were there other companies that did that at the time?
Yeah,
I think that's
really
what he was.
It stood Exchange Telegraph Company.
Yeah.
And I think United Newspapers ultimately ended up buying them. Robert Maxwell was
right.
Interested in them at some stage. And of course, you had companies like Reuters,
yeah,
and subsequently Bloomberg. But it was really that it was in a physical format,
yeah,
that made it interesting.
I remember him saying he had lots of it stacked in his bedroom, and that's all that was in there.
That's it.
Okay, now, Paul, I wanted to go back a bit further, really, because I know that you were brought up in the borough of Brentwood, and is it Shenfield?
That's correct.
And I wanted to go back, really, regarding your education, where you studied, etc., to bring us up to speed with the journey so far.
Well, I have to confess, my education was up until O-levels, and at the age of 16, I can't remember how many I actually got, but I worked out sort of from a fairly young age that I wanted to work in the city. I had sort of family history of being involved with the city, but there were two things that I was interested in. One was the, I think I learned this through delivering newspapers on my paper round.
Okay.
Big houses used to take the Financial Times.
Yes.
So I used to think to myself, oh, I must get myself familiar with what this newspaper is all about. And my other key subject, I loved maths at school.
Oh, right, okay.
And so really it was sort of marrying up those two ambitions and thinking to myself that that's where I wanted to head.
Very astute, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's how you journey, yeah, headed towards that from your studies.
Indeed, now. And I sort of really, I was so keen to get working that I left school, so I didn't apply for A-levels, much to sort of the annoyance of my of teachers at the school, who felt that particularly with maths, I should be pursuing that further. But no, I just thought the market environment was right, and we were talking about pre-Big Bang in the city,
yeah,
in 86. The market was having a strong period, and recruitment into the city was strong at the time, and I just took the decision to go for it, and I haven't regretted that decision. Not something I'd necessarily would have been encouraging my own children to be doing these days, but it was just opportunistic at the time and sort of worked out quite well.
Excellent. Now, so after that, then you did your O levels, you went straight in. What your very very first job? What were you doing?
Well, literally, as a 16-year-old, you start off photocopying, filing, And a lot of administration tasks where you're assisting the team.
Yeah.
And I know we can all sort of look at a filing job and think, well, that's quite fascinating, because I was filing the Excel cards.
Yeah.
And as a result, you became very familiar with every company that is listed on the London Stock Exchange.
Yeah.
Because you see their card and you become familiar with the names of each company. And then gradually over time, you sort of just become a little bit more inquisitive about what does this company do? And as we'll possibly come on later to how did I start then dealing in shares, you start looking at the balance sheet and you start looking at the profit and loss. So I used to pride myself on the ability to be able to sort of know most companies, if not all of the companies on the London Stock Exchange at the time, and have a fair idea of what they were up to.
Excellent. So you went in as 16, 17 years of age. You did that. You basically learned all the background stuff and did your what would be now deemed as an apprenticeship, really, at Extel.
Yes, and Extel was Extel at the time. I was called into about 6-8 months into my first job. I was called into the director to see one of the directors.
Yeah.
A chap called Rick Bowie, I remember his name, and he asked me in to say that they were working on quite an exciting new project. And the idea was to develop a database that monitored every single M&A transaction, not just here in the UK, but as far as possible globally. And so it was an ambitious project, and they wanted me to work on the team. It was being led by two of my colleagues from America.
All right, okay.
And I was given really the opportunity to work 7 days a week, as many hours as I could, with overtime pay rates. So it was able to sort of boost my pay. And over the course of the next 18 months or so, we built ourselves a fairly comprehensive database, which was to be used by investment banks. So to give you an idea, if a client came in a particular industry and said that we're looking to take over a business in our sector, the investment bank could cross-reference any previous M&A transactions to work out valuations and what was the appropriate price to pay. So that was the objective.
Yeah.
And having built it, my next job was then to try and sell it. So I effectively was sent out on the road to visit companies like Shearson Lehman, Morgan Grenfell, for example, to meet their corporate finance teams and talk about the database that we had built.
That's fantastic, Paul. So at 18 years of age, you were heading off selling something that you'd helped build.
That's it. And it's
absolutely fantastic.
I have to say, if you're sitting in front of 30 Morgan Grenfell finance executives and you're 18 years of age,
exactly,
you grow up fairly quickly.
Well, that foundation has put you in very good stead, mate, it would appear. You know, there's no looking back from that, was there?
No, there certainly wasn't. And actually, in fairness, that was where I secured my next employment, because it was on the circuit that somebody picked up on me and suggested that would I want to sort of move from Extel to my next vocation.
And which company was the next one then, Paul, after that?
Well, it was interesting because having been sort of slightly snooty about the fact that, oh, I'm off to see Morgan Grenfell or Lehman, I was then given the task of visiting a small firm of accountants, and I thought, well, I don't know if I do small firms. I'm large, actually, investment banks. And,
okay.
So I walked into a small firm of accountants, and there were two or three individuals there who I was presenting to. And then a chap came into the meeting halfway through. And his name was, David Williams. And David, at the time, was the development director of a company called Mosaic Investments. So back in the sort of late 80s, you'll remember some quoted companies like Mosaic Investments, Cannon Street Investments, and these were sort of fairly active acquisition vehicles, buying businesses with the objective of improving their value almost like private equity, but through a quoted structure.
Yeah.
And he was the development director, and he had an office. He was overseeing the M&A team at this small firm of accountants. And it was he actually who said why don't you come and work for us in a sort of research style role.
Okay.
And, so it was the sort of next leg up for me then. It was working in a more professional practice, but more focused on research.
Okie doke. So at which point did you meet Matthew Hoare?
So Matthew, I first met Matthew Hoare and Paul Killick had put the business plans together for a new stockbroking firm.
Right, okay.
So Paul Killick was at the time senior partner at a firm called Quilter Goodison.
Right, okay.
And he decided that he wanted to set up a new style of stockbroking company. The difference was that rather than having a sort of grand office behind a brass plaque in the city, he was going to have a more like a retail unit and more akin to what the American model, the Merrill Lynch model, was looking like.
Okay.
So he moved over to really the Chelsea area to open his first office. And Matthew and my boss at the time knew each other. And I met Matthew and Paul through that process and literally attended their sort of opening party, their first year anniversary party.
Yeah.
And that's how I got to familiar with the guys, and that's when I opened my first stockbroking account personally to buy and sell a few shares. And so I opened my account with Matthew. He became my broker.
Ah, okay.
And, it was only through that process that Matthew was, I think, generally intrigued by my share dealing on the basis that I used to pull up some very sort of weird and wonderful names of companies that he'd probably never heard of.
Which you'd found via the Excel sheets, yeah?
Indeed, absolutely. and so that's how we met and started talking on a regular basis about sort of shares we were buying and selling.
Excellent. So your first stock then, which you started trading with Matthew and your first account?
Yes, yeah, so my first stock was a company called Norman Hay PLC.
Yeah.
I think it's an interesting story, so I'll tell you. The Excel card, the company at the time was valued at just about £3 million. It was tiny. But I'd spotted the company driving along the A4 heading out towards Heathrow. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, that looks quite a large piece of land that they own down on the A4. And so I sort of pulled out the Excel card. And I remember at the time seeing that the freehold land was 7 acres down on the A4 and hadn't been revalued since 1938 or 39. But a sort of crude assessment of what that land could be worth today, it just felt like the business was, you know, the value of the land was worth well in excess of the market capitalization. It had a relatively ungeared balance sheet. The business itself was electroplating, which I didn't know much about, but it looked like it was sort of breaking even and to making a small profit. But I just thought to myself, oh, there's some real value there. So I bought some shares, and I seem to recall at the time they're about 15 pence per share. And it was sometime later that an announcement came out that a chap called Roger Seelig had taken a stake in the business with a view to changing the direction of the company and moving it into looking to realise value. Roger at the time, or at the time, Roger was best known as one of the city's top deal makers.
Oh, okay.
He was at Morgan Grenfell at the time when they were advising Guinness on its takeover of distillers. And I remember at the time he was a big name in the city. And so he joined the company having taken a stake, and the shares literally quadrupled on his involvement.
Fantastic.
And so it was a great introduction for me, because I felt A, you know, you'd done your homework, you'd spotted something that the market hadn't really spotted. That value then appreciated, so I had a sort of very successful debut on the shares.
Okay, and then Matthew started to take notice of your picks after that, I take it.
Yes, he did. Yes, absolutely. And we, you know, he used to give me some ideas as well. So that's how a good broking relationship, you know, should work. And that's the sort of relationship that I like today. Clients who, you know, have ideas, come to you, talk through ideas, and you bounce off their broker. So it's sort of that relationship's held true, you know, over that period of time.
Excellent. So what came next after that, then? After that particular...
Yeah, so I then found a company called Clyde Blowers.
Okay.
And a funny name. But this business used to produce what we know as soot blowing equipment. And it was a tiny, tiny business. But I had quite a successful run with this share. And if you actually look up Clyde Blowers today, the chap who actually ended up buying that business is on the rich list as a result of the success of that company over 20 or 30 years. And it's turned into a fairly major international business under that same name.
Excellent, excellent. So you had two very, very successful hits to start with when you started trading.
Yes.
And with regards to that, were you a sort of person at the time then that would take some of those returns, or were you running the returns as much as you can to maximise?
Yeah, I mean, I think you always have to, you know, sort of remember where you are, and, you know, take into account your own circumstances at the time.
Of course.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, I've always tried to sort of see a company through its development. I mean, I've held to the view that if you actually think back to people who held on to Microsoft, and it's easy to look back and say, oh, you bought the shares in 1979 and you still hold them in 2017. But, you know, you think about the sort of emotional roller coaster that entails,
yeah.
You know, that when a share has doubled for you and you think, well, that's good, I can go on a nice holiday, and then it's quadrupled, and, you know, suddenly it becomes sort of fairly material to you in relation to your circumstances and whether you can buy a house or certainly pay off some of the mortgage with it, and to still continue in running the risk,
yeah.
And through the ups and downs. And there were some pretty sharp pullbacks, you know, times
indeed,
where those guys would have seen the difficulties of holding a share and having the courage to hold a share through those down dips. And I think, you know, so I've always tried to sort of treat something as 10-year investments. And I'm not saying at all that that's right, because I could give you ample examples of companies that I hold and should have sold 6 years ago and saved myself a lot of heartache and
yes.
stress relating to it.
As we all, yeah.
But if you are going to make what I call the big money out of shares over a 30-year career, it's the regrets of the ones that you sold too quickly that is the thing that will always make a material difference.
Indeed. Now, so you've been trading in stocks then effectively since you were 17 and a half, 18?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
So with that, you've learned an immense amount, and you've also enabled other people to learn from your experience, in the sense of you then went on to set up Killick & Co. with Paul Killick and Matthew Hall. Yeah? Yeah.
Well, Matthew and Paul had set the company
up. All right, sorry.
So they were the co-founders.
All right.
Them in 92, so I probably joined them 3 years after they started the company. So for the previous 3 years, I was a client,
okay.
And then it was only really a matter of time before, you know, the suggestion was that I would come along and actually work with them.
Okay, so your first role at Killick & Co. was what there then?
Well, pretty much at the time, it was building a client base.
Client base, okay.
So privately, I had spent 3 or 4 years taking the examinations which were pertinent to the stockbroking industry. So investment analysis papers, interpretation of financial statements, the compliance examinations. These were all things that I did privately, to supplement my sort of 4 O-levels or how many ever I got.
Yeah, I was going to say you made up for the time you'd walked away from your O-levels. Exactly, brilliant.
Absolutely, no, made it sort of relevant to where I wanted to head. So I was able to sort of move into a role, which was a client handling role. And at the time, there was a lot of interest, we're talking about the early 90s, in this new tax wrapper, which is the was known as the Personal Equity Plan, renamed the ITE. At the time, we had created the first create your own PEP. A lot of the PEP market was controlled by companies like Invesco, where you just buy into their funds. But this was a self-select. This was where clients who want to choose their individual shares or investment trusts or collectives could put it in. And really, I was on the front line. I was the sort of new client acquisition sort of head, as so people walking in through the store, through the shop, sorry. Would come in and open an ISA, I would be there to handle that.
Brilliant.
And again, you know, in the stockbroking world, we all want to have the client that walks in the door and, you know, hands you over a check for hundreds of thousands of pounds to build a portfolio. But I was really excited about the client that walks through the door and says, there's £6,000, I want to put it into a PEP for this year. Because what you do over time is that you find if you do a good job for people on their sort of individual general PEPs, that actually you've got half a chance of convincing them that the money that they've got held elsewhere with maybe rival stockbroking firms, you know, could ultimately move your way. So really,
absolutely,
as a young guy in the industry, you've just got to you know, prove yourself. And build a client base, and you end up meeting some extraordinary people, but through the initial introduction of a general PEP or a single company PEP.
Yeah, absolutely agree. So also about nurturing relationships there, isn't it?
Indeed, absolutely.
So you were quickly promoted then, Paul, because obviously you recruited and gained a lot of new clients for the group, and you became a partner shortly after that.
Yeah, and I think Paul and Matthew worked out fairly quickly that they should try and lock me in, which was great.
Yeah,
and so it was a case of becoming an equity partner of Killick & Co. required you to buy into a share of the company, which at the time, you know, was a fairly significant investment. Well, a very significant investment for me. I mean, it was something that would have made my parents' eyes water. Your attitude at the time is one of, let's take the risk. This is a business that was starting to do very well, and it was a huge opportunity for me to be able to sort of buy into at a young age.
Yeah, because you're still in your mid-20s at that stage, I take it.
Yeah, I would say I became 24, so I'd have been 5.
Wow, okay.
So I look back on it now and I think it would probably give me sleepless nights taken on, but at 25 you take the risk, and I'm jolly pleased I did.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You've not looked back. Now, Killick & Co. As it says in the bio here, spawned lots of different businesses as well. Seven Investment Management, Raymond Jones Investment Services. It just went on and on. So you and Paul and Matthew brought in other people to help you grow all these different.
Sure.
Bits.
Yeah. I mean, that's right. The core of the business was doing very well, and it was building its market share. And but there were plenty of ideas along the way that still kept a sort of core of private client stockbroking, but it may have been some sort of different areas of the market that if we found the idea compelling, interesting, and you had the people who could hopefully build it, then there was always a a desire to have some projects on the go, and so that was it just meant that the when you're working, it creates a great environment if you've always got some other things which other opportunities to potentially invest in and see them develop. I would say that Seven Investment Management is today the most successful that was spawned out of investment from Killick.
That's now the main person there. Is it Justin Hercart? Is that the
Justin
right name?
Justin Hercart. And Tom Sheridan.
Tom Sheridan. Yeah.
But there are seven of them. I'd love to name them all. They've
ever so well. Yeah.
Great team, and they came to us with the business plan and the idea in the late 90s, and look where they are today. And it was a pleasure to be part of that journey with them. Yeah. We sold our interest, I think, in 2007. Tom, Justin, David Carroll, those guys, remain very, very good friends to us today.
Excellent, excellent. I'll be interested in interviewing a few of them at some point, Paul. Now, you have been in the past very astute in a sense of writing various articles, and it was in the mid 90s that you started writing a column for the Sunday Times.
That's right.
How did that come about?
Well, that was it was very fortuitous and opportunistic. In the money section, the Sunday Times, the editor at the time, a chap called Paul Hamm. As you can imagine, the money is of the Sunday Times is really where investment firms spend a lot of time. It's where people will read up on personal financial matters.
Yeah,
you've obviously got the business side, which deals with trying to break stories, but the personal finance section for pensions, investments, all under that section. And the one area that they didn't really cover to any extent was the share market. It used to be all about funds, but they didn't really talk about shares so much. And they were looking at the time at possibly introducing a share column. My name was put forward as somebody to potentially look at. I wasn't well known. I'd at the time undertaken a few television interviews with the BBC. And I remember at the time that they were thinking about Jim Slater, Jim had at the time created the PEG annual, so he was very well known. But I think I just met an editor who didn't necessarily want to go down the same route of saying we've got Jim Slater, because Jim at the time was he literally was everywhere.
Okay.
And I think they wanted somebody new, so Paul very kindly came along and said let's write a column. And I was given pretty free he said he wasn't too prescriptive about what he wanted. I mean, we just sort of, it really adapted over time. I remember my first article was, I wanted to make a big play for technology, the technology sector. And at the time there was a technology trust. It was the Touche Remnant TR Technology Trust that was designed as a split capital investment. It had a capital growth share and it had an income share. This was in the day when telecom companies used to pay out income, technology companies, so they could produce an income. And so I made a recommendation for the capital growth share of the TR Technology Trust, and that was my opening column.
Okay. Because I mean, obviously, in the mid '90s, it was all about tech as well, wasn't it? So you didn't go aggressively in; you went for a fund at that time.
Well, that was the first. I mean, I think in my first and last, because we then started to pull out some companies.
Yeah.
And there was some businesses around at that stage, companies like Scion that had developed the handheld device, which. Like the I suppose the electronic version of the diary.
Yeah.
You had like Arm that were Arm was a development out of Acorn Computer.
Acorn. Yeah, I remember it well. Yeah.
And companies like Baltimore Autonomy.
Yeah.
So and you know and a number of companies that were just beginning their sort of life on the markets at that stage.
Excellent. And then from there on, you've gone on to be on Radio Times, Radio 4 Today, Radio 5 Live, BBC, yes. Sky, CNBC as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and the CNBC I've been doing, I would say, for 20 years. So it used to be, in fairness, CNBC used to be a little bit more focused on the UK market, and they've become much more international in their development now. So there's less time, I have to say. I'll still do CNBC, but the subject matter can be a little bit more around the economy, or it can be around HSBC's results.
Yeah.
So less what they used to do. You know, we used to have a few more sort of individual stock ideas, but I think CNBC have become much more macro in their opinion, or obviously large cap.
Okie dokie. Now, Paul, I'm trying to get a gist of what type of investor you are. Could you describe yourself to me in a sense of with your own personal investments? Would you say you're a low risk, cautious, long term?
No.
Okay. Go for it.
Definitely. I've a consistent theme for me is tends to be higher risk, small caps. I've very rarely bought large cap companies. I don't necessarily see the reasoning why I would necessarily stray into that area for me. So it's more for trying to identify companies that I could see as would make multi-bagger style returns, and okay. And so therefore you would have to say that I'm in the ultimate high risk category on the personal side, but you know, I want shares that can ultimately make a bit of a difference.
Okay, so when you say small cap, are you still looking for companies that are listed on the FTSE, or do you actually have a portion of your portfolio in AIM stocks as well?
Most of them would be AIM stocks.
Okie dokie.
Yeah, most would be AIM stocks. So it wouldn't. And I don't really sort of invest so much in funds. It's more individual stocks that I like, and tend to take larger positions in them, as a result. So I have some current conviction, which is the is what lets me down.
Okay. So when you're screening for this, because obviously, as I've spoken to so many people before, it's unusual for fund managers to of someone of your stature to go in that sort of space of AIM and smaller companies. What sort of criteria and filters are you using to pick those stocks, Paul?
Well, I'm fairly one of the things you're fairly blessed with by being in this job is that you get to meet lots of people, and as a result of that, you tend to hear about companies that one should be looking at. So some great fund managers who will talk about their sort of, you know, top three ideas at the moment. That's always a good filter for me.
Yeah.
In terms of sort of building up that database in my mind of companies that I suppose the. I used to try and equate this that you know you've given a lot of information that you have in the background of your mind, the company, the marketplace sort of recollection of their sort of last few trading updates, how the market tends to react to them in terms of sentiment towards the shares. And this is all sort of interesting information, but not much use until one day it is.
You sometimes
spot something and you think, ah, now that reminds me of a particular company I was looking at, and I wonder how they're doing. So I try and absorb as much data as I can in my own mind, and then sometimes these things just come together on the day. And so it's, I try to avoid any sort of formal screening of what I'm looking to achieve. This is really for me personally. I'm really looking at just sort of specific, special situations that will come to me. But there's a lot of background work, and a lot of the data becomes highly irrelevant and redundant. But every now and then, it's the right company at the right time.
Yeah, I mean, there's a great saying by Seth Klarman: the stock market is the story of cycles and of the human behavior that is responsible for overreactions in both directions.
Yep.
So you've just got to be, sometimes it's all about timing, and then getting the timing right for the entry, and then staying with it and running your winners, isn't it?
Absolutely. The other advantage I feel I have is you know, once invested, is getting familiar with the people who run the company. Again, having that, pick up and keep regularly in touch with their progress.
Yeah.
That's the other advantage that you have by being within the industry. I know organisations like your own are looking to sort of break down the barriers as much as possible. And between that, and I think it's you can't have enough information. That's my point.
Yeah. No, that's a very valid point. It's something that's been reiterated a few times by some of the people I've had on Conker's Corner thus far, about looking into the eyes of some of these CEOs and CFOs, and, you know, getting to know them very, very well, you know, intuitively about the business is very important. Okay, Paul, so you've stated that you're a small cap AIM sort of investor. Looking at the whole of your portfolio, what would you say as a percentage is allocated across the whole portfolio in AIM, FTSE, global stocks?
So FTSE and global stocks, zero.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, genuinely. So really the two areas for me, special situations.
Yep.
And the second area is trading.
Yep.
So we've got one of the things which I've held the view on is that this market it's had a period of what I call calmness, and I think that's going to get shaken up a little bit over the course of the next few years. I think the calmness has been delivered by this sort of rather extraordinary world we're living in, with zero interest rates and QE programs and cash sloshing around the financial system. And it's really just, it's taken a lot of volatility out of the market.
So lots of intervention is interfering with the market, yeah.
Yeah, and it has been over the last few years. But at some point, we are at a point now where that intervention is having less and less impact.
Agreed,
and
yeah.
I basically see over the next few years that companies that have exploited volatility, so we're talking here about financial businesses, some hedge funds, you know, absolute return strategies, etc., which have, to be candid, have been sort of left to the side a little bit, you know, their performance being seen as a little bit dull. I would see them coming back over the next 5 years, and anyone developing alternate investment returns compared to, say, conventional equities are going up, bonds are going up, you know, the oil price is going up, gold's going up. It's going to be those that can actually extract an absolute return in more difficult markets, I think, are going to have their day again in the next 5 years. So that's another area of interest for me.
Okay. Do you have a sector preference, Paul?
Well, I mean, I try to avoid practices, but I probably would say that technology, when you come into the come into this industry and say, well, what sector is going to have an impact, both positive and negative, over the next 30 years, you can't
avoid tech, can you? Yeah.
Biotechnology, I think, is the same, but I don't understand it as much as I should. And as a result, that's a livelier sector. But you have to say that over the course of the next 10 to 20 years, that sector will continue to create the opportunity, not just for buying shares, but actually for thinking hard about sectors of the market, traditional sectors of the market that are going to be impacted, and what sort of level of impact will they have. So I try to keep a sort of fairly close eye in that space.
Okie dokie. So you've got access to lots of brokerage notes. You see and meet with these fund managers. How much time do you spend away from that researching the stocks before you pick them for yourself?
So the way I tend to try and break down my day is that mornings are, say from 7 a.m. through to lunchtime-ish, yeah. Hand over towards really just having your head down, going through the morning news, trying to keep abreast of the sort of developments in the markets. I always read big cap reports because they're very, very detailed, and they give you clues as to the trends that are happening. So I try to use those sort of 6 or 7 hours in the morning for head down that type of activity, and then in the afternoon that is given over more to clients, thinking about sort of the business, how you're going to grow your business, and sort of new client leads, those sort of things, things say would be non-research based. So that's how I try to break down the day.
Okie dokie. Now, given that you've been in the industry now, Paul, since the mid-80s, what has been the greatest lesson that you've attained since you started investing?
The greatest lesson? Well, the first thing to note is that when I joined the industry, it was quite easy, being sort of brutally honest, to convince a client of your sort of prowess as a stockbroker and your knowledge. And that was because they had no information. They didn't have access to information. And so as a result of that, you could possibly say, oh, there was a very interesting quarterly update from B today. Yeah. That would be very impressive. I would think, good, that's why I'm paying my stockbroker so much money. And of course, now you can't get away with that. I mean, I would have to say that, the level of knowledge that is with the private client community is fantastic. And so my career has seen that sort of whole industry spawned for chat rooms and places that people can sort of develop reputations and learn information. And you just sense it when you're speaking to clients now that they know so much. So it has taught me that I've got to continually raise my game. And continuing to be relevant, because what we don't want to do is find that robots have taken over and we are redundant in that respect. And so it's actually still holding on to what you believe is your value add. And that is, creating good ideas, being responsive to clients, hopefully giving them some fairly decent advice for things to buy and things not to touch, and try and bring that to bear. But I would say the biggest lesson is, never be complacent. This industry is moving very, very fast. It's still a good industry to operate in, still a good industry to build a career. But the hurdle is being, or the barrier is being raised all the time for it.
Yeah, and it's moving so quickly because of tech and the speed of social media and information highway. Indeed. So you touched on robo advisors, Paul, and that seems to be lots of talk about that going forward in the next 5-10 years about taking a lot of growth away from the standard sort of brokerage companies at the moment.
Sure. Yeah, and I think these things are coming. You know, there's no question that for large swathes of the financial planning and investing markets, that a more automated approach is going to have its place and take I think fairly considerable market share. And I think it's also going to have fairly profound impact on the cost, which can only be a good thing.
Yeah.
One of the points that I think over the next 10 or 15 years, and you know, to bear this in mind, is the fact that if you think what is the risk-free rate of return at the moment? Because you know, whenever anybody's sitting there assessing, you know, what returns they're likely to make out of their investments, you know, what return is available in a risk-free asset? And the answer is zero. And in fact, it's $12 trillion is suggesting it's a negative rate of return. And everything gets priced off of risk-free rates of return. So the net result of that is that over the course of the next market is telling you that your expected return is going to be somewhere probably 2-3% per annum. You know, expect no more. Now, you're talking about an industry that has sort of thrived on the back of 6, 7, 8, 9% annual returns being delivered out of financial markets as a consistent. And the industry has obviously built its cost base around that.
Indeed.
But if you now start heading into a period where investment returns are going to be down at the 2-3%, then clearly that's going to have a fairly material impact on the conventional model of asset management. And so, you know, I'm not suggesting that tomorrow the industry gets ripped up and you know is redundant, but it's a gradual creep that the more that process can be taken away from human intervention, and the more that a good job can be done for large swathes of financial planning, it ultimately to bring down the cost of it, then I think it's an unstoppable machine.
Absolutely agree. I mean, that sits well with the next question I was going to ask you as a segue. As in last January, you started Patronus Partners, and that was about keeping in step with what's going on with technology-wise and the business that you've seen grow rapidly over the last 30, 40 years.
Yes. Yes, no, I mean, I mean the key with Patronus is it gave us first of all an opportunity to build our own model. There's no question that when you've been within a company that's built up over 20 or 30 years, that you end up with a lot of legacy sort of ways of doing things. And it was something that wanted a really, you know, you only get one opportunity at this, but when you start with a new business, you get an opportunity to review every business practice. And what can we do to sort of reduce cost? So I think my starting point on number one, I mean, you often normally start businesses on the basis of, you know, how much revenue can I create?
Okay.
But this one was, how can we do this as cost effectively as possible? So that then you can try and be as competitive as possible with how you charge out your services. And I'm not saying we cracked it at all, but all I want to do is make sure that we come in with competitive offerings. So, for example, you know, if we're in the world of conventional investment management, discretionary investment management, where you know you're investing on behalf of clients across a multi-asset range of equities and bonds, commodities, absolute return strategies. So one thing I want to be able to do is impose our view on the world, which bit more radical than a conventional style portfolio.
Yeah.
And then how can we do it in a way that's as cost effective as possible, so that you know we're there to compete over the course of the next 5 or 10 years. So we've done that. I mean that took a lot of work to get ourselves to that point. And we're now out marketing for, you know, investors who have got pension funds and long-term money that they want allocated sensibly, have a robust investment process. So that had to be built. But the beauty of it for us was building it on a platform which kept those costs as modest as we can in that environment. So then in other areas, where can we add value? I know that the industry, certainly the what I would refer to as the professional institutions, I mean, it's fair to say that there are probably only two or three investment funds now that are active in the sub £100 million market cap market for AIM stocks.
Yeah.
People like Gervais Williams, you know, who got great reputations in that market, but there are very, very few of them now. And so for the investment banking community, they don't really support AIM in that sort of category. And if you've got private clients who dearly love to play in that sector, I say play, sorry for giving my wording play, but, you know, certainly look to look into that sector, it's because they see opportunities to find things that other people have looked over and missed. They can see shares that can move fairly quickly when there's momentum behind them. And so it's really saying, well, OK, you know, there's a niche opportunity for us in terms of adding value to that space. It's not to say that we're going to come up with the 10 best ideas on AIM. My best ideas have often come from clients, you know, who do the homework, and you think to yourself, oh, I'll look into that company because that sounds quite intriguing. But it's more a case of, you know, other areas that I think you can add some value is that a lot of people, you know, do invest through online, and they trade online. And I know the advantages of, you know, sometimes having a dealer on the end of the phone talking to a market maker and trading in the old-fashioned sense. I know the value that we can add in that area. So if I can summarise, it's what we're trying to do here is think very, very hard about where is the value add. That's when you can charge. That's when you can get your half-sensible margin in this business.
Yeah.
And don't try and compete with what I call the inevitable trend of reducing costs for things that become highly commoditized.
Indeed. So you're in a position now where you've created something where you can differentiate for the other 99% of companies that are out there doing the previous piece of work that you've left behind.
Yep.
So you're preparing and put together Patronus for 2020, 2025, 20, you know what I mean? That's what you're heading for.
Absolutely. It's a lot of the work that goes into starting a new stockbroking company. I mean, first of all, you probably spend 8 to 9 months getting your regulatory clearance. It's a huge task, and one which probably took 8 to 9 months. But once you've got it, obviously you've got to cherish it and preserve it and make sure that the business is doing everything it should do. It's then developing white label relationships. I could go out there and try and, you know, sort of rebuild Rome, but there are some fantastic businesses out there that provide the sort of services we need under a white label. And it was really having that network of companies that are important to us for, you know, we've got clients who trade, you know, sort of quite significantly in currencies, in indices, futures markets, and it's really having the best of breed offerings to allow us to deal directly, you know, with the futures exchange, you know, as much as possible. Often people to trade indices, they'll do a bit off the pricing of, say, an IG markets or CMC markets.
Yeah.
But we often deal with the crude products, you know, in terms of some of our trading strategies. So it's really just building those networks with fairly big companies who can deliver to us, you know, significant resource. It creates this sort of virtual company for us, so that all that we really want to do at the end of the day is sit in a relatively small office with a relatively small number of people, looking after clients, and then everything else sort of takes care of itself.
Yeah, looking for the best ideas. Now, I know you just went on hold for a second there.
Sorry.
It's all right. I noticed as well there that you to do all of that heavy lifting at the start of Patronus Partners, that you brought in Kareem Khoury and John Pryor, two quite significant high flyers in the city.
Yes. Yeah, no, well, it was the three of us that worked very closely together at Kinnick. So it was only at the time natural that if we were going to start a business, we would do it together.
Yeah.
And I think our skill sets are very complementary. We don't trip over the toes of each other. In John Pryor, I genuinely think we got one of the best investment minds, who is when I say across the different trading markets of currency indices, CFDs and spreads, he's very, very familiar with them, with the marketplace. And so I define him as, in a sense, as our CIO. And and Kareem is the guy when I refer to, having put the regulatory structure in place for Patronus. Yeah. He was the guy at the start of it, said it will take 8 months. And, if it took 3 minutes more than 8 months, I'd be surprised. He was spot on with that.
Excellent.
And it's really, it's having somebody who generally is making sure that the lights come on in the morning and that everything is working. A great operating officer. I'm not quite sure what I do, but anyway, I'm third leg of that particular stall. But it works well, three of us.
Excellent. So, no, it's been running since January 2015. You're coming up to your 18-month anniversary. How's it gone, Paul?
It's gone. I would say it's gone as we expected. However, beneath the sort of cover of the sort of headline, it's remarably different to what we set out in our initial business plan. Things positive surprises, negative surprises have broadly balanced each other out. But I'm pleased to say that, where we've got to over that period is, A, getting the regulation, getting the infrastructure into place, getting clients across. I mean, the one thing that I would say that I sorely underestimated is just the different environment we now operate in with regards to signing a new client up to a firm.
Yeah, because since things went wrong, there's more and more red tape. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I can't say that any of it. We often talk about sort of European regulation, how that's having an impact on us. But it's really around this whole issue of know your client suitability analysis. I do go back to 25 years ago. You wouldn't dare ask a client a question that involved anything sort of a personal nature. How much do you earn? You wouldn't even think of it.
Yeah.
And in today's world, you need the full fact find, because it's that information that you rely upon in giving your advice. So the process of bringing a client into the firm is a longer process, and one which can be quite daunting to some clients when they see the paperwork and think, gosh, I've got to sign this. Yeah. But actually, when they do go through the process, they everything has relevance. Everything has sort of, okay, I understand why this all needs to be asked. And remembering, we are in the advisory business here.
Indeed,
Also discretionary. So I would say that that's been one of the points.
Yeah, I mean, I think now, even on with the work that we do now, we have events every now and then, and it's important to have people either self-certify or for us to clarify what level of wealth they've got, and that the information that they're getting, even though we're not giving advice, is appropriate for their circumstances, so they can assess their own risks, and we can assess the risk they're exposing themselves to. So it is quite important.
Indeed, absolutely. And it reminds everybody about what we're all entering into.
So. Exactly. Indeed. Yep. Indeed. Right. Okay. I think I may have the answer to this already with the previous conversations you've had. What has been your wisest investment decision to date, Paul?
I haven't mentioned this one, but what I'm sort of quite proud about is a company called Entertainment One. Peppa Pig.
Yeah, I know all about that one, yeah.
Yeah, so basically when that company first came to the stock market in 2006, I think, it's a Canadian company, and they were listing in London, and they ended up with a long list of sort of shareholders who were the sort of the exciting hedge funds of the time. So he had a register, shareholder register, that looked very, you know, very sort of cool. It wasn't your traditional sort of a Scottish institution. It was more likely to be a hedge fund based out in the US or something like that. And so it came to the market. And of course, when the financial collapse happened in 2007, all of these hedge funds went bust. And they were desperately trying to extricate themselves from all investments. And as a result, Entertainment One, their share price went from 100 pence to 13, dropped by about 87%. Wow. And a couple of sort of close business associates who had been involved with the listing, their company's called Marwin, decided that enough was enough. The business didn't warrant this sort of level of depreciation, and they made a tender offer. And I thought, well, that's a good signal for me. And I actually bought an investment in that company. And then really started something I wanted to explore, but was how can we help this business turn around the sentiment? And I remember at the time sort of making some introductions to some good stockbroking firms who I thought could help deliver the growth. And I also introduced it to an institutional investor who liked the story as well. So it started to impregnate the business with the background for the recovery of its share price. And the shares rallied from and I think they trade at 254 as we speak. But and you will have noted that ITV had a bid rejected for the company, and KKR apparently looking at them at the moment, according to the Sunday Times.
Yeah.
But that was, for me, just almost like a case study of finding something that the market had overlooked, and then working with the company in a very informal capacity. I had no formal capacity at all, but just a general interest in wanting to see this business succeed. My only regret on this one is actually I did come out of my investment or bulk of my investment too early on this along the way. But nevertheless, it was a good investment.
Excellent, excellent. So that was a very good return there, and it does appear now that finally the content that it's got available to it and its assets are being, well, nearly fully valued. We'll see. I still expect there's going to be another company coming in for Etiopol.
Yes.
There's a third one coming. I'm not sure who, but I suspect that content and streaming is king, and Peppa Pig is just one portion of ETO.
It is.
So I hold the stock at the minute, and I'm hoping to head towards 280 to £3. So we'll see.
Very good. Very good.
Okay. Given the many lessons that you've learned since you started investing, which one would you most wish to share with our audience, Paul?
In terms of investment lesson?
Yes. Because what I love about interviewing yourself and the others that I've interviewed is that you've just touched on it with Patronus, that you guys are still learning, even though you've got 30, 40 years experience. We have newbies coming into the market every day, and they're like, Pete, how do we do this? Wheelie dealer, how do we do that? Paul, what's this? What does this mean? So, you know, you've learned loads of stuff, and you're still learning, and, you know, Buffett is still learning.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to summarize in the form of say one lesson, but I mean one of the things that I wish I'd listened to more, if I can say, was, and I know you've heard this a million times, but it really is relevant, is sometimes your gut is telling you something's right or something's wrong, and you don't listen to it enough.
Yeah.
And I've often held companies which, to be candid, I've seen begin to decline, and my gut feel suggests that there's something relevant to it, and I've ignored it.
Okay.
And I've sort of held to this. Well, no, I've done my analysis, and I think we're fine here.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's one of those sort of issues where sometimes your sense on these things is more powerful. There's one other thing that I think is relevant It was. I've seen an example of this in recent times with some quite experienced investors who have identified companies which often people go away and look at those, private investors and brokers, and say, I'm not sure I'm seeing what you're seeing that makes this worthwhile. And I've seen share prices go up by 10 times their money on things that couldn't necessarily be analysed at the time. I'm talking about companies like Goodwin PLC, which I remember at the time looking at that thing. I'm not sure I necessarily see what it is. And I was looking at all of the data that you could pull your hands on, all of the screening processes, all of this, all of that, you know, conventional analysis, and still saying, do you know what, its balance sheet's fine, it's quite clean, and its profitability is this, and its P/E ratio is that. And it wasn't enough, because the investor who, you know, investors who did see that opportunity found out something more. They certainly saw something that the analysis or the backward-looking analysis or indeed the forward-looking 12-month analysis wouldn't share with them. It couldn't share, because you were taking a much more strategic view about what it is. And I think, so if there's one piece of analysis here is that, or one piece of advice, is that sometimes all of this information that we have creates this situation where you don't look up sometimes and just think very sensibly about what it is, you know, this business does and where will it be in 5 to 10 years' time. And it needs a little bit of imagination. It creates a little bit more risk in your analysis, but at the same time, it's where I've seen the most money being made by investors in that sense.
No, that's a great point, Paul. I think a lot of investors are looking at what the company is going to be doing in the next 3 months and 6 months, rather than further out. And I think you touched on Arm, which I've held since 2008. It's a prime example of looking way out. You know, the future of tech or the future of bio, and even the future of alternative energy. You've got to be looking way ahead as to what these companies' technology can do and whether or not they'll continue to reinvest their money on R&D as well, which is a prime example with Apple, which got wrote off back in the 90s and is now one of the most dominant companies in the world.
That's it.
Exactly. Okay. We've got a few more questions for you, then we've finished, Paul. If there was one thing you could change regarding the investing landscape, what would that be?
Ooh, one thing I could change. I'm not sure. I think there's not much I would change. I mean, there are lots of things we would love. I mean, for example, smaller spreads in small cap.
Yeah.
It's a very sort of niche market, and spreads can be very wide. So we would like that. I think there's a lot of noise around, but these are all things that you can control: your own environment, what you want to listen to and what you don't want to listen to. You know, the regulatory bodies have still got a lot of work to do in order to ensure that, you know, the businesses that are there, you know, listed on the markets are what they say they are. And there's obviously some good work out there from people who can dig quite deep on certain situations and highlight that. But you would like to think that they don't have a role in life, because the regulatory bodies get it right. But it's a bit of wishful thinking there in that respect. And so that's that. So you know, from my point of view, I think you know, it's about creating your own environment. Not everything is perfect, but it's actually through your own experience you create your own environment as to what you want to listen to and what you want to ignore.
Excellent. I love that. I love that answer. Thank you. Now, Paul, what would you say is the best kept secret to investing or trading, one or the other?
Well, the best kept secret around investing or trading.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, it's it's not so much a secret, but it's something that people should really understand, is the cost of trading, and what sort of hurdle that creates in your ability to be able to make money over and above what I call a risk-free asset or a tracker.
Yeah.
People don't tend to analyze their own trading costs. And one of the things that, and I'm not making the dispersions here, but in terms of, I'm not making sort of criticisms of the industry, but other than say that you've really got to understand where the costs are of doing business, and understanding what over the course of a year that creates, in the sense of I need to exceed that in order to be able to sort of deliver a return for myself. And so I think a lot of people enter into the trading market in a quite an unstructured way, and wonder why they end up losing their money.
Yeah. And
too much. Too many people losing too much money.
Yeah.
And a lot of work got to go into that education process. I think to be candid, the account opening process is for people's ability to be able to lose money is too low at the moment.
Yeah.
And, I think almost you need to have some sort of test to go through before you get into that world. So I would say that in terms of a secret, it's not so much a secret, but it's really you know, as lack of transparency,
yeah,
which you've got to break down, you've got to understand it, and then give yourself a reasonable assessment of your own ability to be able to make money given the hurdles you're creating for yourself. I know, you know, in terms of some of the accounts that we can, you know, can see, one wondering why, and you just look, the people put themselves in a virtually impossible position ever to make money by their trading strategy. So there is a secret there. It's about sort of the focus as much attention on the cost of trading as it is of the shares you're picking. Because that's something that's not easily identifiable, and you only really work it out once you've worked out at the end of the year why you've lost money.
Yeah, and also over the long term, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, those costs do erode the value of your returns.
Easily, yeah.
Okay, I've got one question, Paul, and then I'm going to ask you another one regarding books, and then we've done. What would the Paul Kavanagh in 2016 be telling his 17-year-old self back in 86, 87?
I've got a 17-year-old son, so I'm probably thinking about what I'm saying to him.
Okay, go ahead.
Just the thing, my big miss was the development of the US technology market, really. If I look back on that, thinking about the huge businesses that were created in the US over my investing time, and for me not to necessarily have picked up on this at an earlier stage. I'm talking about Starbucks, and I remember Google in 99, those sort of businesses. And it's not complicated. It, you know, genuinely is not a complicated situation. We overcomplicate things. And if I would had the experience of what I have now, and I'm going back to being 17,
yeah,
is don't overcomplicate things. You know, just stick with sort of your view on the world, what's going to happen over that period of time, and almost like invest and then sit back and relax. But, you know, that would have been what I'd have done.
Okay. I think. I mean,
the problem in our world is we come into work every day to be busy, and actually, you don't necessarily need to be busy with investing. You know, it's almost better that you don't come into work if you were just investing in your own shares. But we all like to be busy. We all like to think that each day we're going to create some added value for ourselves. And sometimes all we're doing is taking value away from ourselves by being busy. Overcomplicating things. So that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to simplify. I'd like to have simplified my investment process back 30 years ago.
Okie dokie. I mean, that there's a great quote from Benjamin Graham. The individual investor should act consistently as an investor and not a speculator. That sits well with you buying, sitting back, and letting the good companies just run.
Indeed.
Okay, I've got one last question. I wanted
Yep.
to talk. I'm a big book fan, and I believe there's lots to be learned from speaking with individuals like yourself, but also historically how other people have done what they've done trading, investing, regards to writing great books, etc. So I just wanted to ask you, are you a book fan? And if so, if there's any books that you've read and would recommend to our listeners?
No, my I had my head in a book in my 20s, which was because you had to put the examination
Of course, he studies, yeah.
together. And so the books that I've tended to read have tended to be I tend to read a lot of sort of biographies, or indeed sort of capturing sort of events in time. And really understanding just a little bit more of what was going on at the time. Fascinated with, the sort of Treasury Secretary, Geithner, who, was there during the period of the financial crisis, and really understanding a little bit more about what was going on behind the scenes, because none of us were really aware of what was going on behind the scenes, and now you just become wiser to the sort of things that they think through. And so I tend to the film The Big Short was written off a book that I which I absolutely loved, one of Michael Lewis's books. And again, talking about four different sort of investment funds and why they all came onto this particular trade at the same time, and what it was that drove them to thinking about that. The word catalyst comes to mind. What was the catalyst that created this sort of big change in direction to the market? We shouldn't lose sight of the fact that in 2007 there was a catalyst
Indeed,
which
yeah.
was that the build-up of debt finally changed the direction of markets. And what we've done to try and correct that position is obviously load up with more debt, because we're trying to wash through the impact of it, and hopefully, it will all go away. We have not got rid of the risk. Central banks have not got rid of the risk, and what they have done is try to disperse it across a greater period of time.
Yes, indeed.
It's a gamble. It's one that can pay off, but when we start to hear talk at the moment of the Bank of England struggling to implement QE and struggling to do this, struggling to do that, you're getting to a point where there's going to be a catalyst. There's going to be something that's going to change this course of events. And so I'm really interested in sort of the books that sort of understood a little bit more what was going on in 2007, because I genuinely believe that we're going to be entering into a period, certainly in my investing lifetime, which is going to result in a fairly rapid change of direction again.
Yeah.
And I want to see it happen, know it's happening, and what to do about it, and guide. So it's something which may happen next week, or it may be 3 years away, but there is definitely, in my sense, something that's beginning to shift. I'm not surprised that the stock market is going to breach 7,000 again. Interest rates all across the world are down at zero, unlikely to move for years,
Yeah.
and that creates a situation which is going to, you can feel it bubbling,
Yeah.
and something's going to break, something's going to change. And I like books that really are giving just a little bit more sort of information around that whole space.
Yeah, so more about preparedness, really, in terms
Indeed.
of what's going forward.
Yeah.
So with regards to 2007, 6, 7, 8, are there any authors that have written books that were ahead of the herd regarding knowing what was, they saw things happening that you'd say, these are the guys to be reading their material now?
Yeah, I mean, basically what you want are names, and I'm not very good at remembering names.
Okay, sorry.
So I will. I'll have to drop some comments down at some point as okay. to as some good reading material. But I would say that you're looking at some fund managers, but you're also looking at some economists that have been guiding in the US and writing books that I've read. I just can't remember their names at the moment.
No worries. Well, if you DM me, I'll add it as a tag on the wording I do for your podcast. Now, Paul, I've covered all my questions. It's been absolutely fantastic to have you on. You've shared oodles of information with us, and it's going to be fantastic for our listeners. Is there any closing point you wanted to add to round off this interview for us?
No, I mean, just that it's the market I love, I love the fact that people, you know, people really enjoy the hunt for looking for the next big winner. I love the enthusiasm that people share for their investments. How much information they dig around. Be under no illusion, you know, I find a lot of information out about businesses just by the information that's shared within the private investor community. So, it's been a real welcome interjection into my life. And so the key is just keep remaining interested.
I completely agree. I think the great thing about it is now, obviously, as you've touched on before, is that you've got so many different stratas of social media and the speed of information being shared with just private individuals and not necessarily higher net worth individuals is absolutely astonishing now. And that's what we're hoping to engender at LSE Share Talk and enable private individuals to have a greater voice, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. And make sure companies do listen. I'm sure they do.
Yes, indeed. Okay, Paul, thank you ever so much. That was Paul Kavanagh of Patronus Partners. Thank you for being on Congress Corner, Paul, and I look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Super, thank you.
All right, take care. God bless.